The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Let me give you just a little bit of background. If I gave you a full detail, we'd be here for weeks, because he's an amazing person. I should mention that, and I told him this, that he has actually been, Mr. Greenfield, has been one of my favorite political analysts. I used to remember tracking down when he was going to be on, because his analysis and also his humor are quite interesting, quite unique, and the combination is very powerful. Currently, he's CNN's senior political analyst and a contributor to The Situation Room, American Morning, and Paula Zahn Now. He's got a law degree from Yale Law School and an honorary degree in laws from Union College. He has a very interesting professional background, high pedigree. He was a legislative fellow in the office of Senator Robert Kennedy, historical time. He was also assistant to New York City Mayor John Lindsay. He's been a political consultant. He's lectured at Columbia Law School. He's been a media analyst for CB News, for ABC News. He's been host of CEO Exchange on PBS and a syndicated columnist for Universal Press. Busy guy. His books include The Advanced Man, A Populist Manifesto, No Peace, No Place, The World's Greatest Team, Television, The First 50 Years, National Lampoon's Book of Books, and I want to find out more about that. I'm sure there's a story there. Playing to Win, An Insider's Guide to Politics, The Real Campaign, The People's Choice, and most recently, Oh Waiter, One Order of Crow, about the 2000 election coverage. He's also been writing for over 40 years, published in Harper's, Esquire, New York Times Magazine, New York Times Book Review, New York, Newsday, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, National Lampoon, so he's got his cred. Oh, did I mention he's won 4 Emmys? Silly me to have forgotten that. And also the Quill Award for Meritorious Journalism. He's been a Carsey Wolf Center industry fellow this term, and also he's taught 2 courses, a seminar on ethics and politics. I would imagine there's a lot of material to deal with there. And Political Media in the United States, Historical Survey, your class. And this is his last presentation in this second class, and he's going to discuss lessons from past elections about the media's role in presidential contests and what to expect in 2008. I'm pleased to introduce Mr. Jeff Greenfield.
Hi, welcome to those of you who are not part of the captive audience for this class. Welcome. At the end of this lecture, after you leave, we will be distributing the final exam. Those of you who do not get out in time will be compelled to take it, even if you're not enrolled in the class. I just want to let you know. Please do not take the 4 Emmy thing seriously. News Emmys are not like the real Emmys. They generally mail them out under the address occupant. So it's a little less fancy than you might think. I need to first of all express my gratitude for the fact that I'm spending the winter here. I met Chancellor Yang, I don't know, several years ago, and we idly talked about someday I might teach here. And then I met Dean Marshall, and we less idly talked about it. And thanks to a number of people who were here, it's become reality. The film studies chair, Anna Everett, who I believe if you could harness her energy, could power a major American city all by herself. She is absolutely a remarkable force of nature. And to be blunt about it, saved this course by figuring out that I needed a lot more help than I thought I did. And my gratitude to you is great. Her colleague, Constance Penley, who showed me around here, the communications chair, Michael Stoll, the political science chair, Professor Holley. Mary Hillegas works in the communications department. She's one of those people without whom the entire university would crumble into dust. one of those people who, you know, makes things happen. And I'm grateful as well to the community for making me feel welcome. I came out here 10 years ago and discovered that this is one of the really remarkable places on Earth, Santa Barbara, and I haven't changed my mind. So what are we going to do tonight? I'm going to talk for a bit about something more specific than just the campaign, although that will inevitably come into this. And then I'm going to field questions from you that you will have written out. Let me be very candid with you. I've done this in other places for one very simple reason. There are some people, and I'm sure none among you, who, if I can borrow something from our 42nd president, are not sure what the definition of question is. Just for the record, a 10-minute comment followed by, "Don't you think I'm right?" may sound like a question, but it's not a question. Or questions that begin after the earth cooled and take us through this gentleman's or lady's history of 20th century and 19th century politics, that's not a question. We'll do this for the sake of concision and to get more questions answered. So that's why we're doing that. So let me begin with a little background, which the students in this class have heard probably to distraction, but I'm not much for theory. I'm a journalist. I generally deal in concrete stuff. I don't have an elaborate construct when I look at politics and media. But one thing that I have believed for some time is that if you try to analyze politics through the lens of the media, you are making a mistake. It is like looking at a landscape through the other end of the binoculars. My view tends to be, and always has been, that the changing nature of media has changed American politics less than either the purveyors of this media or its critics think. That American politics can be seen, I think, more clearly by understanding certain fundamental aspects that, in my view, have always been a part of American politics for reasons that have to do with the country in the first place. Now, I'm repeating myself, students. You probably don't have to take notes on this, but the idea of the outsider, the non-establishment figure who comes from someplace other than the center of power to lead the country, which most other countries, by the way, would find absurd, has been part of American life at least since the election of Andrew Jackson in 1828. And time and time again, you will see voters choosing what in other countries would seem unlikely figures. Governors of small states, peanut farmers, ex-actors, over establishment figures, incumbent presidents, and people with 30-year records. Now, people will use the media to make that point, to prove to the country that they are outsiders, that they are ordinary Americans, all the way back to the log cabin campaign of William Henry Harrison in 1840. I'm one of you. But it isn't the media that create that appetite. The media, in my view, are feeding, and by the way, media, that's a plural. Media create this, or rather deliver this, because of something much deeper inside the American belief that the outsider is more trustworthy than the insider. That's just one example. The other thing that I would argue is that certain fundamentals that cause people to vote one way or the other remain constant. As a general rule, a bad economy, whether it was a bad economy in 1892 or 1992 or 1932, will unseat an incumbent president. A corollary of my first point is that, generally speaking, in American politics, character trumps issues. Because this is one of the few countries that elects a head of state who's also the head of government. You know, in England, the Queen's the head of state, the Prime Minister's the head of government. Even in France, the President's the head of state, but the Prime Minister's the head of government. And sometimes they're from different parties. We don't do it that way. And so the function that a head of state in a place like England, Great Britain, has, is embodied in the same figure who runs the government. So we are choosing at one and the same time somebody who's going to execute a set of policies and somebody who kind of embodies the American spirit, who we are, which is why so often we will vote for somebody who on a straight issues list more Americans disagree with than agree with. But we choose that person because that person speaks more to us. He's more like one of us, whatever that might mean. And yes, sure, political figures will desperately use the media to make that point. One of the things that the students in this class have seen, one of the first great, and by great I mean consequential, examples of this is Richard Nixon's Checker speech in 1952. Senator Nixon, running on the Republican ticket, accused of maintaining an $18,000 slush fund, buys a half hour of television time and tells the American people in detail, here's what I own, here's what I owe. This is my mortgage, this is my savings account, this is my life insurance policy, this is the value of our car, to say, look, here's who I am. Now, it is true, in my view, that television as a medium opened the door to that kind of intimate connection in a way that previous media did not. But the impulse to identify with the ordinary American, long before Richard Nixon talked about the silent majority in a speech as president, he was, as a United States senator, making the same point. I'm connected to you. I'm not with the elitists. I don't own that fancy stuff. In the Checker speech, Nixon has this great line, sort of backhanded slam. He says, now it's a fine thing that Adlai Stevenson, who was born a millionaire, can run for president. But I happen to think that other people should be allowed to run for president too. That kind of impulse, that kind of statement, what he is getting at in that speech, is something that the media didn't create. So that, I want you to see that as my notion. And as Dennis Miller is often wont to say, I could be wrong. And indeed, as you'll see, there's stuff in the new media that is causing me to wonder whether or not, however brilliant this thesis of mine may have been, it may be perilously out of date. It's one of the things we may find out in 2008. So, to where we are now. First of all, this campaign is starting real early. One of the reasons I came out here this winter quarter, apart from the fact that I knew what the weather was going to be back east, is I thought, well, this is the fallow time. We've just had a midterm election. The presidential election isn't for November 08. The first caucuses aren't until January of 08. Surely nothing will be going on now. And to my surprise, there has been this explosion of candidate announcements and media frenzy that make it seem more like it's October of 2008. When Barack Obama went to Springfield to announce for president, at the home of Abe Lincoln, in case you missed the point, 500 journalists went with him. My own feeling was, does anybody look at the calendar? Do they know that this is not a leap year? But the answer is yes. Now, just to take a step back, why has this happened? It has happened in part because of what is going on in the political calendar. And once again, take a look at the interplay here between media and bigger political events. Let's just take a step back and begin with why this campaign has begun uncommonly early. Ever since 1952, when New Hampshire had a first-in-the-nation primary that won national attention, when Dwight Eisenhower beat Robert Taft and Estes Kefauver running against Harry Truman, who wouldn't even campaign because he thought primaries were stupid, won that primary, that has been the start of the campaign season until 1976, when Iowa decided that its caucuses would matter. A guy named Jimmy Carter, looking for some leverage, this unknown ex-governor of Georgia peanut farmer, zeroed in on the Iowa caucuses, which take place before the New Hampshire primary, did well, placed second to uncommitted, became a national figure, and ever since then, Iowa has become important. Just as a matter of personal opinion that I feel I'd like to share with you, the Iowa caucuses are essentially a fraud. Why, you might ask? Because nobody shows up. I mean, nobody in terms of the electorate. Most Iowans, it's a very civic-minded, literate state, very good people, and Iowans know that going out of their house in January, in the middle of the night, is a stupid thing to do. You who spent your life in Santa Barbara might not relate to this, but January in Iowa is, it's very cold, it's usually snowing, the roads are perilous, they're icy, and you'll get frostbite if you're outside for more than 30 seconds. And unlike primaries, where you can run out of your car, run into the local school and vote, the caucuses, which originally started as a kind of civic, let's talk about local issues, that's what they were originally supposed to be about, have now become this 4 or 5 hour event where you go into a school cafeteria or union hall or library and wait so that you move around a room and join affinity groups, and the result is nobody shows up. The percentage of Iowa voters who actually turn out for the caucuses is way under 10%, and that's in a year when both parties are having them, for all of the hoopla. New Hampshire's a little different because you can vote and that turnout is high. But basically, Iowa and New Hampshire now have a belief that when Moses came down from the mountain, there were actually 11 commandments, the 11th of which is, the first caucus shall be in Iowa and the first primary shall be in New Hampshire. It is written, I have spoken, I am the Lord thy God. Why do they do this? Well, there are two reasons. One is, for 3 years and 11 months, nobody gives a rat's patootie about Iowa and New Hampshire. But for those couple of months, they are the most important places in the world. There used to be a head waiter at the Hotel Savory in Des Moines who for 1 month of the year was the most important head waiter in the world, because Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley and all the whole crowd was screaming for tables. And local political reporters become national political reporters. The second reason is, a couple of years ago, a couple of economists in New Hampshire did a study and figured out, I think this was like 12 years ago, that the New Hampshire primary dumped $250 million into the state. And by now, with the cost of living, it's got to be closer to $500 million. Why? Television time, radio time, people like me going up there, staying in hotels, eating in restaurants, and stupidly forgetting that it's winter in New Hampshire and we've brought loafers and we have to buy galoshes. I have a theory that as the primary season approaches and the caucus season approaches, every restaurateur and hotel operator moves the decimal point on their price list because they see us coming. So what's happened is that every time somebody says, why do we have to have Iowa and New Hampshire go first? Why don't we rotate this? Those states say, you can't. And candidates quite rightly figure, if I refuse to participate in these events and I'm the nominee of my party, I may risk those electoral votes. Because Iowans and New Hampshireites, before they are Republicans and Democrats, we are first. It has gotten to the point where New Hampshire has a law that it must go 1 week before any other primary. And now that the Democratic Party has trying to get other events closer to the Iowa and New Hampshire caucuses, a Nevada caucus and a South Carolina primary, the New Hampshire people keep threatening to move the primary back. No matter when the primary is, they're going to move it a week earlier. I fear, by the way, that if this keeps up, the space-time continuum will be broken. And as John Stewart pointed out, we may already have had the New Hampshire primary without knowing it. Now, there's a point to this rambling. The point is that because of the enormous media attention paid to Iowa and New Hampshire, many times the coverage that accrues to states like Illinois or New York or California, what's happened is all of the big states have decided we need to be early. So California used to have a primary in June. Then it moved it to March. Just today, Governor Schwarzenegger signed a bill moving the primary to February 5th. Something like 20 other states are going to move their primaries to February 5th, including New York, Florida, I think New Jersey, Illinois. And I'm going to come back to this point later because we don't have a clue as to what this means. But all of this is being done in part to try to get these big states the kind of attention that Iowa and New Hampshire have gotten in the past. And you can see, by the way, the political consequences of this. All the candidates running in Iowa magically are for ethanol, the corn-based alternative to gasoline. There is a huge federal subsidy for ethanol. I think it's 50-something cents a gallon. And, by the way, there is an enormous 50-cent a gallon tariff that keeps Brazilian sugarcane ethanol from being brought into the United States. So all these candidates who tell you they're for the environment and that's why they're for ethanol, ask them if they're in favor of removing the tariff on Brazilian sugarcane ethanol. Because let me tell you something, there ain't a lot of sugarcane growers in Iowa, but a lot of people grow corn. And somebody once said, if the first caucus was in Idaho, we'd be making gasoline out of potatoes. And there's something to that. So in an effort to overcome all this and to say maybe we could get things on the national agenda that relate more to the 30-something million people in California than the 1 million or so in New Hampshire, they've all moved their primaries and caucuses or primaries to February 5th. So why? What does this mean? In the olden days, say back in 2000, it was still possible for a candidate to come out of nowhere, underfinanced, win an early test, as John McCain did in New Hampshire, and become a viable figure for the primaries that were coming several weeks later. The idea now that all of these candidates are looking at is saying, well, my God, a week or so after New Hampshire, there are going to be 20 states with as many as 80 or 100 million people in them holding primaries. We're going to need a ton of money to compete in those states, and we can't possibly wait until we win some surprise victory in Iowa and New Hampshire to raise that money. So we better go out and raise it now so that we can be competitive in those big states and we can even survive a loss in Iowa and New Hampshire. That's why all these people are out there. Now, the consequence of this is, in terms of the coverage in the media, rather startling. First thing is, it has been a national holiday for the cable news networks. I mean, I'm not sure if you appreciate the burden of trying to put on news 24 hours a day. Every so often you catch a break. Either something really important happens or Anna Nicole Smith passes away. And given what you need to succeed in cable news, a tiny fraction of the audience, if you can find 500,000 misbegotten souls who find this a compelling story, day after day after day, in terms of cable universe, you get good ratings. But now we have a presidential campaign to cover. A year before we, or 6 months before we thought we had to cover one. And what do we do? Well, what's happened so far is that the media are using the same tools they've used in a more truncated and compressed presidential campaign to cover this campaign with hilarious results. For instance, we're polling. Every day, we're polling. And we get some really interesting results. For instance, just today, you could have learned from the Time magazine poll that Barack Obama has dramatically closed the gap with Hillary Clinton, going from a 21-point deficit to a 7-point deficit. And boy, that's pretty interesting news. But if you don't like that news, you can look at the Time magazine poll released almost the same day that shows that Hillary Clinton has the same 15-point lead she had 3 weeks ago. That's what I call really interesting news. You don't like the first poll? We got another poll for you. Now, I admit to you, I am a longtime skeptic about polls. I think the use of polls by the media is at the risk of offending people, it's kind of like a Tourette syndrome. We just sort of spew these numbers out, and because they're numbers, they look important. We're not just telling you what some cab driver told us, like the old-time magazine. We got a number here. It's 56-41. Numbers don't lie. Well, if you believe these polls, apart from the fact that the CNN and the Time poll, by the way, they're owned by the same company, Time Warner. I don't know what that means. But when you look at that, what you should conclude is that polls taken this far before an election are worthless. And indeed, if you go back in past elections and look at this period of time, this far out, you will find that, for instance, The leading Democratic candidate at this point in the 2004 cycle was Senator Joe Lieberman. And the leading Republican at this point in the cycle was Elizabeth Dole in 2000, actually in 1999. The smartest thing anybody ever said about polls, in my view, was said by Kevin Nealon on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, where he said in a recent poll, 85% of Americans said if the presidential election were held today, they would really be surprised. There is wisdom there, because at this point, we are so far away. We are so much in a world where the great majority of reasonable people have not yet begun thinking about their vote because they know they don't have any vote to cast for a year, so that these numbers reflect nothing. It simply is beyond common sense to believe that 20 million Americans in the last 2 weeks have changed their mind about who they're voting for president and will change them back again, if you believe these polls, based on what? Nothing. But we take polls, because that's what we know how to do. And so one of the things about this new calendar is I think it has trapped the media into ignoring what in their saner moments they know about politics. That what you're looking at now is a false picture, not deliberately false, not conjured up, but false because it's kind of like turning on turning a camera on a baseball arena at 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, you're just not going to find out much worth knowing. The best evidence I can give you for that was that all through 2003, Howard Dean was the story. He burst onto the Democratic Party scene by boldly declaring his opposition to the war. He brought on board people who were much more expert in the web world than anybody else. He outraised every other Democratic candidate. This obscure ex-governor of Vermont that nobody ever heard of was raising money hand over fist. And by October of 2003, Al Gore had endorsed him. And the question literally I was asked by at least one of our anchors was, is it all over? Has Howard Dean won? Is the nomination his? And I know what I said. I said to her, could we let somebody vote? Just anybody. Could one person vote before we start making these judgments? Herb in Minneapolis. Peggy Sue in Phoenix. Somebody cast a real vote. What happened was when the calendar flipped, and it got to be January of 08, the people of Iowa, bestirring themselves, or at least that handful that decided to vote, said, oh, yeah, there's a caucus coming up, isn't there? Maybe we should actually start thinking about this instead of answering poll questions based on name recognition. And for good, sound political reasons, Howard Dean's campaign, before the famous scream, basically collapsed. But if you looked at the polls all through 2003, we had, you know, the media had Howard Dean anointed. So my concern now is now that we're starting this process months early, if we keep behaving as though this is one long, continuous election that is really in full tilt right now, full throttle, we're going to constantly, I think, make judgments that are rooted in nothing. I have this more poetic way to describe this. When sometimes nature goes a little crazy, and years ago up in the northwest corner of Connecticut, where I spent some time, there was a freak snowstorm in September, 12 inches of snow, before the leaves had fallen. The way nature works, it's pretty smart. First the leaves fall, then the snow falls. If the leaves are on the trees when the snow falls, the weight of the snow pulls those trees down, and that's what happened all over southern New England. Cable lines down, power lines down, chaos. And I have a real concern about whether or not, in a political sense, we're out of phase with nature in starting a campaign this early. But let me show you now where I think this new campaign may have new media rules that may really change the game in a way that people like me are clueless about. Okay? Let me quote to you one of the most popular figures on this campus, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. No, I think I actually did run into a Republican here. I'm not sure. I didn't check it out. But I think maybe I did. Anyway, Donald Rumsfeld is well known for saying that there are knowns, there are known unknowns, and then there are unknown unknowns. The known part of that this campaign is it's starting real early, and we see what the candidates are doing with traditional media. The known unknown is we know we don't know the consequence, for instance, of this new calendar. There are people who think the primaries, that the February 5th date will end the campaign, and then there are some who say, wait a minute, you're going to have three or four candidates in each party well-financed. They might split the vote. February 5th will come and go, and we'll still go on. We don't know that. But the unknown unknowns are where I'm heading. Okay. So what's traditional beside this lunacy of polling? Well, one of the things you may be noticing is that the candidates are spending more and more time trying to find non-traditional sources of communication with the public. From the earlier days of television, people began to realize that this intimate medium of television was really particularly effective if you weren't communicating as a politician, but as a human being. As far as I can tell, this first emerged when John Kennedy, as a Democratic nominee, went on the Jack Parr show to just kind of chat. Actually, before that, he went on person-to-person with Edward R. Murrow before he was running for president. Media, in other words, trying to use the media to communicate, I'm a regular guy, I'm an okay guy. And over time, we saw more and more politicians do that. Famously, Richard Nixon in 1968 went on Laugh-In, which was then one of the most popular shows on television, a quick sketch variety show, to just look at the camera. Their tagline was, "Sock it to me." And you can see this, Richard Nixon looking at the camera going, "Sock it to me?" In an effort to prove that he had a rollicking sense of humor. Okay. But we saw Ronald Reagan much more comfortably banter with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Jimmy Carter went on What's My Line as the ex-governor of Georgia. Without blindfolds, the panel couldn't tell who he was. Bill Clinton, many of you know, went on Arsenio Hall wearing shades, playing his saxophone, playing Heartbreak Hotel to show that he was not some elitist from Oxford and the Yale Law School. To the point where in 2000, both George W. Bush and Al Gore not only went on Saturday Night Live as themselves to participate in their own mockery, but both went on Oprah. So what's going on this year? Well, one of the things you've already seen this year is odd kind of moves by candidates and possible candidates to almost mock the announcement ritual. If some of you who saw the Academy Awards may remember Al Gore going on to get his Oscar and to say, I have this announcement to make, and then the band played him off. Barack Obama went on Monday Night Football looking like he was going to make a very formal speech, and it turned out he was put on a Chicago Bears cap and said, let's go, Bears. And John McCain went on David Letterman to announce that he was going to announce. And was bantering with Paul Schaefer. Now, this is simply, to me, an accelerated use of this trend in media, which is find a place where people don't expect politicians to be, where they can let their hair down, where they can kind of relax and show that they are not stuffed shirts. One of the most popular venues of this has been Don Imus' radio program, which I have been a captive member of for some 15 years. Out of nowhere, starting with Bill Clinton in 1992, major politicians go on Don Imus, they get insulted, they're often treated to some fairly bawdy jokes, but why do they do this? Because they want to show the one unforgivable sin in American politics is not to have a sense of humor, or to be more precise, to be seen as not having a sense of humor. So this is part of the ritual. The idea that 30 or 40 years ago a candidate would go on, say, The Daily Show and be subject to some pretty sharp, withering satire, or go on Don Imus and be badgered by this often misanthropic guy, nobody would have done that. No press secretary would have allowed it. What are you doing there? Today I just read the one new media form that the politicians are beginning to react negatively to is Stephen Colbert, who has had a lot of congressmen on and has really messed them up. My favorite example was he had a very conservative congressman from Georgia who was insisting that the Ten Commandments be posted, I don't know, in every public school and post office because it's really important that our citizens know the Ten Commandments. And Colbert, in character, said, "What are they?" And if those of you who have ever seen Jackie Gleason's The Honeymooners know the answer. Hamna, hamna, hamna. Because this stalwart defender of the Ten Commandments hadn't a clue. I mean, he probably could have gotten three or four. Most of us could. So just today, Rahm Emanuel, who is the fourth-ranking member of the House Congressional Leadership, sent out some kind of message telling his people, stay away from Colbert. He will do you no good. Now, to take you a tiny bit behind the scenes, what happens here, the reason why these politicians do it is that they, you know, nobody of an age of my age or younger doesn't want to be thought of as cool. So what happens is these congressmen's young staff members and interns say, you got invited on Colbert? Wow! Dude! Wow! Or whatever, that's 10 years out of date, whatever. Groovy, whatever you're supposed to say. I know. So these congressmen, you know, until they saw what was happening, said, oh, well, I can reach my younger constituents. Let me do Colbert. Not realizing that the new rules of the game, unlike when John Kennedy went on The Tonight Show and Jack Parr was in awe. May I call you Jack? That was a real exchange, as the students who've seen that clip know. Today, one of the changing rules of the new media is you go into the buzzards arena, you're playing a buzzards game. You are not going to get respect from these people. You are not going to be treated with kid gloves. They are not going to vet the questions. Back in 2000, George Bush went on Letterman, and Letterman's, you know, they had a little top 10 list. That was funny. And then Letterman started asking Bush about capital punishment in Texas and why there were so many executions when he was governor. And I'll tell you something. Letterman did a better job questioning George Bush on this than many of us journalists did. So this is one of the changing rules of the media, that because people are turning to non-traditional sources for their political news, whether it's The Daily Show or Colbert or whatever, and politicians are feeling they have to go there, that, you know, if you want to reach a 30-something voter, that voter is probably not watching Meet the Press. In fact, they're probably not watching the evening news. Now, how do we know this? Watch the evening news and watch the commercials and ask yourself, who do those advertisers think is watching? Do you see an ad for 501 jeans? No, you don't. Do you see an ad for some cool beer where the premise is drink this beer and you're going to have a lot of sex with supermodels or hunky guys, whatever your preference, because that's what beer does? By the way, for you young people, this is a mistake. But those are the ads you're going to see on ESPN and on MTV. What do you see on the evening news? If a Martian came to Earth and watched the evening news, that Martian would communicate back to his leaders, we do not have to invade this country. These people are all going to die in 3 weeks. Because every ad on the evening news, literally from head to toe, is an ad for prescription medicine telling you, I'm losing my hair, I've got migraine headaches, my dentures are falling out, I got stomach pains, everything. To put it another way, the ads are premised on the notion that everything that should be soft is hard, and everything that should be hard is soft. And that is a message that senior citizens, trust me about this, you youngsters out there, get much more clearly than those of you with your fine, firm, lustrous things. But it tells you something. It tells you that the evening news is watched by older people. And candidates and their advisors know this too. And that's one of the things that is going to, in my view, stay dominant throughout the 2008 campaign, that you're going to see more and more an effort by these candidates and prospective candidates to reach audiences in non-traditional means. Now, there's a second aspect to this it's been changing, it continues to change, and that is there are more and more outlets that are almost explicitly ideological. And we are beginning to see some interesting dilemmas in this area. Here's what I mean. In the very first days of the Republic, this is like after the Earth cooled, newspapers were, they made no pretense of objectivity. They were bought and paid for by the various political factions, all the way back to the Federalists and the Democrat Republicans. You read one paper, Thomas Jefferson was a saint. You read another paper, he was a whoremonger and an atheist, and vice versa. And the development of so-called objective press, particularly with radio and then network television, came about in part because they were licensed by the government, and the people running them wanted to reach mass audiences and didn't want to offend anybody. So the tradition in network news was objectivity. Now, starting with the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights era, but particularly the Vietnam War and the Nixon administration, there was a belief that has now become an article of faith among conservatives that the network news, the mainstream media, are basically biased, liberally biased. And there then grew up over time, particularly in the late 80s and 90s, an alternative kind of media. Talk radio dominated by conservatives like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and the like, and then the growth of Fox News, our competitor, which brilliantly found what the economists call an inefficiency in the marketplace. That is, talking to people who believed that most of what they heard and read was unfair and tilted left, and Fox News has a different set of premises. And it's been very successful. So what's happened more and more with the growth of this and the consequent growth on the left of the blogs and the so-called net roots instead of grassroots, web-based communication tending to be dominated by liberals and leftists, and talk radio tending to be dominated by the right, and the, you know, Air America really didn't work as a liberal alternative, and we haven't really seen an explosion on the right, anything like the growth of the blogs on the left, is that now there are sources of information that people turn to reinforce rather than to explore. Now, as I said, I'm not a theoretical guy and I'm not making an ideological argument. I'm sure there are people here who believe that the mainstream media are hopeless corporate toadies. Be my guest. But what I'm saying is that there is at least a sense among mainstream media that we are trying to tell the story down the middle. And whatever our unexamined assumptions or premises, you know, ask Al Gore if he thinks the mainstream media helped him a lot in 2000. But now there's no pretense. Well, I guess on Fox there's a little pretense. But they basically do news with a different set of assumptions. For instance, if there's any professor on any campus that makes asinine statements about how, you know, the United States caused 9/11 and isn't it good that a lot of people died, that will be the headline all day on the Drudge Report, talk radio, and Fox News. CNN is much more likely to do a story about inadequate aid to AIDS victims in sub-Saharan Africa because that's in our DNA. Our founder, even though he's not there, Ted Turner, is passionate about that. So there are different assumptions, different ways of looking at this. So what's happened now, I think, is that there's been a kind of choosing up sides. And interesting enough now, the more politically committed people on both sides look at the mainstream media, or as they call it, MSN, with growing disdain and contempt. We are not, you know, we are just hopeless. One of my favorite examples is there was on Daily Kos, which is a very significant, you know, liberal democratic blog, which at least on three occasions has labeled me an idiot. But I read it anyway because maybe they're right. There was this long fulmination about how Tom DeLay was going to sign up with CNN as a commentator, the former House Majority Leader. And you know, this proves, you know, we knew it all the time, CNN is this corporate, you know, man, look what they're awful and they smear us. And then after this long thing, on the bottom it says, oh, well, actually it turns out Tom DeLay's not signing up with CNN. And it was kind of like Emily Latella, the great Gilda Radner character on Saturday Night Live who used to come on and get everything wrong and then she'd be corrected and she would go, oh, never mind. Well, there is a increased willingness to regard information from mainstream media, if you are a committed partisan, as suspect, as tainted. And allow me a point of personal privilege to tell you my own little incident. I occasionally try humor on CNN, and this has turned out to be a mistake because people don't watch CNN assuming that they're going to see something ironic or satirical. When they see Wolf Blitzer, they see a very serious person who is looking straight ahead at that camera and will not respond to humor. It will be, "Thank you, Jeff, now." Okay. So I was watching the way Barack Obama dressed, kind of very GQ, you know. He doesn't wear ties, and he looks great. It's very casual. It's a very comfortable kind of look. And I noted that there's another, that Iranian President Ahmadinejad dresses exactly the same way. Some Iranian fashion designer has told Ahmadinejad, you know, that don't wear this stuff, you know, be cool. You know, the whole thing with the turban, don't do that. It doesn't work. So I laughingly made the point, said, you know, do you really want to do this? The piece went on, and my wife, who doesn't work in the business and is much smarter than I am, said, you know, there are going to be people who take this seriously. And from my vast, or perhaps half-assed experience, I said, don't be ridiculous. Who could possibly take this seriously? Talking Points memo, Daily Kos, crooks and liars, this vicious attack on Barack Obama, you know, isn't, because the right-wing people were, in fact, using Barack's middle name, Hussein. So, you know, and then I wrote a little blog thing saying, you know, this was a joke. Now Greenfield saying it's a joke, trying to weasel his way out of this. Okay. Obama's press secretary called me and said, you know, we did get the joke. But what I'm getting at here is that this is a phenomenon that we've seen grow. This is the view of covering politics as though the people covering it have an agenda, all of us, and that there is a kind of hidden meaning in this to be translated and told to your supporters. And this is going to be a much more prevalent reality in 2008, and the best proof of this is of what happened to the Nevada Fox debate. There was going to be a debate in Nevada that Fox News was going to sponsor, and this is very kind of traditional. CNN sponsors debates, Fox News, MSNBC, occasionally the broadcast networks get into it. And John Edwards said, you know what, and who had been on, by the way, who's been on Fox 33 times in the last 12 months, I think, said, no, I'm not going to be part of that. I don't think so. And then Roger Ailes told a joke that I thought was a joke that made fun of Bush, using the same premise about Obama's name. He told an audience of news people, now I see Barack Obama's on the move. I'm not sure if it's true that President Bush called up Pakistan President Musharraf and said, how come they haven't caught this guy? Now to me, if anybody else had told that joke, which by the way has been told on late night comedy a dozen times, I think the joke is supposed to be Bush is so dumb he doesn't know the difference between Obama and Osama. The way the Nevada Democrats heard that joke was Roger Ailes, lifelong conservative Republican operative, now head of Fox News, smearing Obama, they pulled out of the debate. This can be a very interesting phenomenon because I have this retrograde, hopelessly old-fashioned belief that there ought to be sources of information that ought to be a source of common acceptance from people with different points of view. I mean, believe it or not, some of us think that's the business we're in. My job when I do a piece of political analysis is not to tell you how to think. It may be to suggest you might want to think about this, but not four legs good, two legs bad, if you know you're George Orwell. Not calling balls and strikes. But more and more, as more and more people come to see, not just the mainstream media as doing this, but also they can turn to their own sources for reinforcement. Fox News, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Daily Kos, Crooks and Liars, Talking Points Memo. This can be a very interesting experiment in how information gets processed. Now, before I turn to questions, I have one more point, and here we come to the unknown unknowns. And that's the rise of YouTube and similar new websites in which anybody can post anything. Some of you may know the best example of the YouTube effect so far is what happened to George Allen, the senator from Virginia, headed to a landslide re-election victory on his way to running for president. And James Webb, his opponent, his campaign sent a person to tape all of George Allen's statements. Well, I'm doing this, nothing wrong with my hand. This is supposed to be like a Hi-8 camera or maybe a cell phone camera. So George Allen sees this guy who is not so incidentally of South Asian descent and turns to him and says, there's this fellow over there, Makaka. He's following us and he's welcome and welcome to America. Well, first of all, the guy is an American, second or third generation American. More to the point, Makaka is a term of racial insult prominent among North African Europeans, of which George Allen's mother was one. So when George Allen said, I don't know what the word means, I made it up. Well, those of you who know anything about the Hebrew persuasion, it would be like me saying, Schwarza? I don't know what that means. I made it up. No, it's a derisive insult to African Americans, and anybody who says otherwise would be lying to you. Anyway, this tape, this incident, nobody would have seen it in years past. There would be no way to get it out unless you peddled it to a TV station. What happened? Now Senator Webb's guy throws it up on YouTube. It goes all over the political community. Local stations download it. The next thing you know, it is the most dominant story in Virginia, and George Allen is now an ex-senator. Now, if you go to YouTube and start looking at what's there now, here's what you're going to find. You're going to find very tough video aimed at different candidates posted by we don't know who. For instance, they run the gamut. You can see Hillary Clinton trying to sing the Star Spangled Banner and making a hash of it. I don't think this is particularly politically damaging because nobody can sing the Star Spangled Banner, especially not Roseanne Barr, and if you remember that baseball game. And in fact, it shouldn't even be the national anthem. America the Beautiful should be the national anthem. It's short, it's singable. That's my opinion. Anyway, that's just a completely irrelevant point, but I thought I'd share it with you. But you will also see Mitt Romney in a 1994 debate with Ted Kennedy, Mitt Romney now trying to run as the social conservative, ardently defending a woman's right to choose abortion, promising to be more pro-gay rights than Ted Kennedy, and repeated and doing this again and again. This has been posted by a group of conservatives who think Mitt Romney is a flip-flopper. You will also see on YouTube Joe Biden shot with a cell phone camera. It's quite clear from the angle, making a humorous remark about how all the convenience stores in Delaware are owned by South Asians. And he says, you can't go into a 7-Eleven without a slight Indian accent. I'm not kidding. Ha ha. Well, he had to apologize for that. And you will see Rudy Giuliani, now the front runner for president, if you believe these polls, on YouTube. You will see him from a 2000 dinner where mayors are expected to perform in skits to make fun of themselves, and Rudy is in full drag. I don't mean a little bit of a wig. I'm talking about full drag, and the sketch is that Donald Trump is hitting on him. I don't know that this is necessarily devastating, but certainly if you were trying to prove to the Republican Party that you were, despite your social positions, a true conservative, maybe that's not the image you want to see. If you want to be seen as the toughest leader in America, the man who stood up to Al-Qaeda, maybe you don't want to be seen in full drag with artificial bosoms and a full head of lipstick, doing, you dirty boy. It's not, that's a real quote, folks. Now, here's the most significant part of this, and this is the unknown unknown. Anybody can put anything on YouTube, and nobody can tell them not to. I mean, obviously, if it's a copyright violation, YouTube, especially now they're being sued for $1 billion by Viacom, will take it off. But there is no gatekeeper. In the olden days, when there were three networks and no cable, television news people talked to themselves as gatekeepers. We would decide what's real news or not. Salacious rumors we wouldn't put on. Hard news we would. And then, you know, with the Drudge Report, we saw the consequence of somebody being able to post something whenever he felt like it that was instantly seen by the entire journalistic and political community with no governor. Matt Drudge is Matt Drudge. If he decides something goes on the front page of his website with a siren, it goes on. And the transmission belt from Matt Drudge to talk radio to Fox News is like that. But now we have something even more dramatic. We have an ability for anybody with a cell phone camera to post anything they can shoot under any circumstances, and it will be seen by everybody. I mean, the Joe Biden tape is like a canary in a coal mine. And what struck me when I saw that was how it was shot. So who makes rules now? What's the role of the media in saying this is real news and this isn't in this world? I believe it is effectively nullified. Most people would think, for instance, I can tell you this as a matter of fact, if somebody shot a picture of a significant public figure in a locker room, naked, that would not be on the air. It would not be on any cable news network. But if somebody's in a locker room with a cell phone camera, in the same locker room with a major, you know, or minor for that matter, public figure, and wants to shoot that and puts it on the air within limits, I don't think YouTube takes that off. And if YouTube takes it off, Dailymotion will put it on, or any of the other five competitors. And that means that this information is now going to be seen by everybody. And that's just one example. You can take a cell phone camera into what's supposedly a private event, let's say, and maybe catch a politician in a thoroughly unguarded moment. Or a better example, which happened to one of my late great colleagues, Peter Jennings. You're in a supermarket, and you're with your kid. And your kid throws a tantrum. And when your patience is exhausted, and those of you who are not yet parents, this tends to happen from time to time. So you decide what this kid is, you know, you smack the kid on the bottom. Now, what happened to Peter Jennings was the next day on page 6 of the New York Post, a famous gossip page, you know, that story was the lead item. Jennings hits kid. Now, imagine if that's captured on a cell phone camera, or you have a bad moment, and you yell, you lose your temper, either for good or bad reason. We go through this. What I'm getting at here is that, in my view, one of the things, the unknown unknowns, is whether or not this new medium will completely eradicate what is left of the private sphere. I don't mean by sneaking into your bedroom necessarily, but by exposing what we normally think of as a private moment to the entire public. And what will they think about that? And how, you know, do we in the media have any mechanism to say, wait a second, let's put this in context. Is this really how we want to judge the next president of the United States because somebody captured this person in an interesting, unguarded moment? This is the world we are swimming in 2008, and what makes me think that my notion that media haven't changed things that much, subject to change with notice, is this is something we've never seen before. This is completely unmediated media, utterly unmediated. And what it means for the political process and how we judge our candidates is something that I think we will learn in the months ahead. But as of now, I can't give you an answer to that question. Let me just finish with one other point, which goes back to traditional media. One of the most interesting questions that I keep asking is, what stuff won't be covered? And what stuff won't be covered because we in the media, some of my colleagues, believe that you won't pay any attention to it because it'll be boring. In a world with 500 or 5,000 or limitless numbers of sources of information, are you going to sit still if somebody like me tells you, you know, this is really important, but I got to warn you, it's a little bit complicated and a little bit dense? 60 Minutes, to its credit, 10 days ago, did an interview with the Comptroller General, the chief accountant of the United States, who basically is saying, if we don't do something about Social Security and Medicare, we'll be broke by 2040. Those of you in the workforce then will be he says, will be burdened with absolutely confiscatory taxation just to pay health and Medicare costs, health and Social Security, and there'll be no money for anything else. Now, do we know how to tell that story so that you won't turn it off? See, in the olden days of three networks, you had no choice. They were all on at the same time. You either watched the network news or you didn't. You know, that's how I tell my kid about my suffering. I don't have a depression story. Do I say, you know, I was your age. There were only six channels. Had to watch what was on when it was on. And, you know, you won't believe this, but if I wanted to change the channel, I had to get up and walk all the way across the room. Well, there was the other side to this, was that there was a time when we could figure out that most Americans, if for no other reason than lack of choice, had to watch the news. And the news people had the power to set an agenda. So what happens if I say to CNN, I can tell you what happens, we really ought to spend some time on this story. I mean, all credit to 60 Minutes for doing it. How do we encourage our politicians to be more bold if the media takes what they say and chops it up into little snippets because we don't think you have the attention span? I happen to think, you know, one of the things I'd like to see a serious presidential candidate talk about is the fraud of the war on drugs. It's a complicated thing to talk about. Most Americans, understand, you know, they don't like the idea of people taking drugs. But the war on drugs, in my view, this is me, is a total fraud. You know, and if you had to choose between a country that whose people were smoking marijuana and whose people were drinking alcohol, it's, I mean, in terms of the damage it's done, it's ridiculous. It's no contest. You know? I mean, you have a nation of marijuana smokers, you know, they might be a little overweight from eating all the cookies. But spousal abuse and child abuse and drunk driving deaths, that's a whole other, people don't talk about that. One of the reasons is they're afraid of the media. You know? Greenfield pro drugs is how that story translates. You know, you know, we got all news channels, but will they actually cover all news? These are some of the things that I'm looking at. But I think what I'd like to do now is to stop and get these questions and see. And I hope the questions are wide ranging. I deliberately avoided predictions. I've avoided telling you who I think is going to win the Nebraska primary. But if you want to ask, that's okay with me. So let me stop and hear what you have to say. Can we see these? Did anybody write any questions? Ah, okay. By the way, just while I'm stalling for a minute, the title of this book, "A Waiter, One Order of Crow," this is the true, unvarnished story of what happened. It was election night 2000. All the networks had called Florida for Al Gore. The Bush people were on the air screaming that we had called this prematurely. And I said, well, it is true that sometimes we have to eat crow, but isn't it true, Bill Schneider, our pollster, that by and large these exit polls are really accurate? At that moment, our anchor, Bernard Shaw, said, Jeff, hold on a minute, we're withdrawing our call of Florida from Gore, at which point I said, oh, waiter, one order of crow. That is the first and only time I have ever seen a quote of mine on the front page of the New York Times. And it had to be that. So, okay. Let's bring a couple of them up. You might as well start now.
They're being censored.
It's okay.
Not being censored. They're being alphabetized.
That's all right. I can flip through these if they're redundant. Okay? Let's see. Here we go. Ah, what is my biggest regret? Good question. You know, there was Xerox stock was selling in 1962. No, that's not true. You know, it's interesting because I've been very lucky. I always wanted to cover politics for a living, and so I did. I can tell you what, it's. I waited till I was 50 to write my first novel, and it's been more than 52, and it's been 10 years, and I have a contract for the second one, and I haven't finished it. So sloth. My biggest regret is that I just did not, I thought I could write a novel every year. I said, this is easy. Look, I've done one. And it's the biggest regret is the temptation not to do what you really want to do in terms of effort and to just turn on the TV. I'm serious about this. I mean, there are plenty of other regrets that are none of your business. You know, I mean, there are plenty of those. But I do believe in a private life. So in this score, yeah, I think that would be it. It's not trying to do more ambitious stuff. Why don't politicians seek out and play to the baby boomers, since they are such a large population? They do. Bill Clinton was the first baby boomer president and played to them big time. The whole reason why he picked, when he chose Al Gore as his running mate, by conventional standards, it made no sense. Al Gore was the same age from a neighboring state with the same politics. And traditionally, you wouldn't do that. There's a 46-year-old candidate for president. You'd think everybody assumed he was going to pick an older guy, from like the East or California. He picked a guy because Al Gore was 1 year younger than Clinton, and it absolutely underlined the fact that this was generational change. Clinton's whole message in 1992 was change. He sounded like a subway conductor at times. Change, 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 change. And picking a guy of his generation, running against George Bush, who was then in his, I think, mid to late 60s, was the symbol of that. So that was a clear appeal to baby boomers. That's my best answer. One of the interesting things about this campaign, I mentioned this to the class. One of the bad things about, I'm so old, I'm older than the baby boomers by a year or two, is, but, the baby boomers, we were young. We were the biggest cohort of young people. I'll temporarily put myself in their class. So we're young. Well, the oldest baby boomer turned 60 this year. That's not young, except in the nursing home. And what's happening now, to me, one of the most interesting things about the Obama campaign is not the rather obvious point that this is the first, serious, never mind Joe Biden's list of articulate and clean, which is he regrets. This is the first genuinely serious possibility of actually nominating and electing an African-American. But there's another part to Obama. He's in his mid-40s. He is post-baby boom. And it's a shock, If you're a baby boomer, they're telling us we're too old? How can that be? I still have my Rolling Stones on the 8-track. That's not possible. Well, yes. And one of Obama's messages aimed right at Hillary Clinton, and Edwards is a little bit doing this because he's a decade younger, is that's the past. So that's the unstated, and actually it isn't so unstated anymore, but one of the key messages of the Obama campaign is get rid of these old fogies who still think that Clearance Clearwater Revival is on the cutting edge. And you're going to see this developing. If you could give any advice to a potential presidential candidate, what would it be? I'm smiling, thank you, because at every debate when they ask journalists, well, what should happen here, some bozo will say, I think that candidate has to appear presidential. And I actually once said on the air, I said, maybe they should like grow a beard, and put on a stovepipe hat, look like Lincoln, that's presidential. I actually think the smartest political advice you could give a presidential candidate is to not listen to your media advisors and to just say what you think. Because people, I think, sense when Bush was it probably will not resonate with this audience, but at his best, when Bush was running for president early in 2000, and he started, people asked him about education, he actually was eloquent and convincing. He was telling conservative Republicans, you have to spend money on this. We have to make these schools better, and it's going to take more money. And it actually was very convincing, because you knew yes, he was talking to a wider audience, but he actually was talking from the heart. I think there's something to this, that when a candidate actually believes something, it becomes much more powerful. I also think, by the way, that to a large extent, voters will, as I said earlier, they will not go down a checklist and decide that you're not fit just because they disagree with you on one issue. If they think you're a straight shooter, and if they think you're tough-minded and can make tough decisions, we've seen this over and over again. And to me, the candidates, okay, one of the most One of the worst things that you can be afflicted with in any endeavor is performance anxiety. It doesn't work at work. It doesn't work on the tennis court. It doesn't work in your most intimate moments. Performance anxiety is a killer. And people sense when a politician has it. And you saw that with Al Gore, and you saw it with John Kerry. I mean, I always have thought, I thought this from the moment it happened. Well, no, I wasn't that smart. A few moments after it happened. At the minute that Swift boat attack happened on John Kerry, he should have called up Bill O'Reilly and said, "You've invited me on the show. I want to come on tomorrow. I want to come on for the full hour. Ask me anything you want." And just look right in that camera and say, "This is the part of this that's a lie. This is the part of it where actually I regret," you know, because part of that attack was that he'd said some really tough things about the behavior of American soldiers. And just go straight at it. And then, you know, go look in the camera and say, "And by the way, Mr. Rush Limbaugh, when you're finished, you know, you're very brave when there's nobody else on your microphone. Invite me on your show anytime. I'm coming. You have the guts to do that?" Why would that have worked? Well, part of what it would have done was to suggest that John Kerry was tough. Was intellectually tough. The other thing is, considering that Kerry lost the white-collar mail vote, the blue-collar mail vote by about 20 points, in part because people thought he was a flip-flopper, that might have had some political benefit. But the advice, in a sense, is to say, don't listen to advice. You know, if you have the instincts to defend yourself and to know how to do that, use them. Don't listen to your advisors who tell you, "Oh, people hate, that's what the Kerry campaign was. Oh, no, people hate negative attacks." No, people say they hate negative attacks. People also say they want to eat more vegetables. People say they want more drama and Shakespeare on television. People say they want to exercise more. Nobody ever says, "I want to see WWE SmackDown and a Victoria's Secret fashion show." That's no, because it's a wrong answer. It's just that they watch it. People, if a negative attack comes from the heart and it's intellectually honest and you've been attacked, it works big time. So that's what I'd say. Why do you think the media has failed to even talk about the possibility that the 9/11 Commission report is inaccurate? That's one of those questions where I'd have to ask, well, where did you learn about this? And I would assume it was some source in the media. I have seen some talk about the other, but there is a reason. It's a report that comes from the heart of the establishment. Very respected people, Jim Baker, Lee Hamilton. It's an all-star commission, and people tend to take him seriously. But I think, by the way, yours truly, actually on IMUS, said, you know, the interesting thing is if you listen to their recommendations, you don't have a clue what they really want you to do. So at least this media person was at least skeptical. Why are you pro-drugs, and why don't you support the troops? Thank you, Stephen Colbert in the audience. But that, by the way, is a splendidly, I hope, satirical, because if not, we need to talk. That's, you know what, this was a cartoon in Tom Tomorrow, who runs in The Independent, where somebody says, this president's policy is a disaster, and then the conservatives say, "Oh, you don't support the troops?" That's where some of the dialogue comes from. Can you speak about Ron Paul's run for a presidential race, adopting the Republican Party in his current attempt? Yeah, Ron Paul is a congressman from Texas. He is a libertarian. I think he's, in fact, not running as a Republican. In the past, he's run as either the Libertarian Party or some other minor party. The libertarian wing of the conservative movement is really interesting. You know what they are. They basically are, get the government out of the boardroom, get the government out of the bedroom. They're anti-war, at least anti-expansion foreign policy. They are for drug legalization. They're pro-choice. They're against pretty much all minimum wage gun laws. And the libertarians were some of those people who were the most unhappy with the Republicans in Congress because they thought they were big spenders, and they hated the Terry Schiavo intervention. Dick Armey, the former Republican leader who's libertarian, said that Tom DeLay and his company, they were just bullies. As is the Christian right, he said. So Ron Paul represents an interesting movement. I am not expecting his campaign to take off. What are my views on electronic polling, online and new media? Well, it's not really polling. I mean, let me back up a minute. I'm skeptical about all kinds of polling. You should know that one of the consequences of the modern era I want to see something among the students. How many of you have landline phones? Take a look, fellow geezers. How many of you have cell phones? Okay. I'm here from Verizon. I'd like to talk to you about a great new plan we have now. Why do I ask this question? Because under the law, polling outfits don't have cell phone numbers. They can't randomly dial cell phones. I don't know exactly why. I just know that's the case. So what do you figure is happening in the polling world if pollsters are trying to reach younger people and they can't dial cell phones? Are you beginning to get... Is the picture fairly dramatic? Now, if you mean about people who actually go online to register their viewpoints, those are not polls. They are something else. It's like my colleague, God bless him, Lou Dobbs, who was, you know, he's on a couple of tears about illegal immigration and broken borders. He's ordered all the Doritos taken out of our vending machines. It's really quite a scandal. He posts a poll every night, and there are objective questions like, do you believe that illegal immigrants who are carrying diseases should be allowed to freely enter the United States and go on welfare? And, you know, like 98% say no. So I'm a little skeptical. How do you think most politicians will battle legally personal moments that are posted on YouTube? Interesting question. Assuming that they are not genuinely horrific personal moments, you understand I'm not talking about serious things or even less serious things. I'm wondering if you've got a picture of an important politician yelling at a waiter, I mean, in a really brutal and contemptuous way, I might think that was an actually reasonable character insight. So I don't know. I have to rethink that. But if it's something, well, look at, you know, Barack Obama, this is in a YouTube incident, was recently, there was a news article that when he was a student at the University of Chicago, he racked up a bunch of unpaid parking tickets. To some extent, I trust the public to say, you know what, I don't think that's necessarily disabling. And in fact, in 1988, the two ordained ministers who were running for president, Jesse Jackson and Pat Robertson, both, it turned out, had their first children, how does this work, the math, within less than 9 months after they were married. So the big scandal was that when they got married, the wives were pregnant. The country cared about that, not at all. So to some extent, we have a sorting out process. To some extent. So I don't know. I mean, it seems to me if a politician, you know, I could actually imagine a politician. Let's take the moment where a guy got into a frank and open exchange of views with his kid. I could see a politician going before the cameras and saying, again, we're not talking about abuse, because say, okay, here's the deal. I will take the vote of every parent who has lost his or her temper with their child at one point in their life, and you can have all the other votes. Where do I sign up for my inaugural suit? There is a way to deal with some of this stuff. It's just that I don't know whether or not that will compensate for this new world that I'm talking about. Does the media, you mean do the media, have the moral responsibility to remain partial or impartial when a life-changing or world-altering issue arises? Let me talk about this for just a minute. I can only do this personally, okay? When I went to South Africa in 1985 with Nightline, I was not neutral about apartheid. I did not go and think, gee, some people think apartheid's fine, some people think it's wrong. No, that's not how I went. However, when I went and was charged with doing a story about what the Afrikaners think, why do they think this way, my job was to tell the story of how the Afrikaners think. And somebody else was doing the other story. So it didn't mean that I went there without an opinion. It didn't mean that my job was not to write a story that said, listen to these, you know, listen to this racist rant. It would be rather to say, this farmer in Bloemfontein has been in South Africa, here's what he says, and the audience, I have enough faith, kind of picked up that this guy was trapped in a mindset. And if you do this by showing the rest of the story, You know, I heard white South Africans talk about how, you know, well, you know, our blacks aren't like your blacks, meaning Americans. And, you know, they really, they're kind of lazy. And then you go into Soweto and you watch the hordes of black South Africans boarding the 4:30 a.m. train to get in to do their jobs. You know, you don't have to do anything but show the facts to tell a story like that. But what you do have to do, I'm giving you another example. I twice covered the senatorial campaigns of Jesse Helms. Now, I had my own opinion about Jesse Helms. My job was to explain to the viewers of Nightline, what's the appeal of Jesse Helms? Now, you could just say, well, it's just racism. But the fact is, that's not the whole story. Far from it. Jesse Helms ran, I think got elected 5 times by being kind of the voice of the common man, standing up to those fancy pants to lead us in Washington. And you need to go into a story as a journalist to try to say, I want to explain what's happening. And I do not have to put that story through my frame of reference. I happened to believe at the time that Jesse Helms was the last unreconstructed racist of the United States Senate. He wasn't a states' rights segregationist, he was a racist. But you know what? Even at the end, Jesse Helms realized that on AIDS he had been all wrong. So how close is the U.S. to fascism? Misspelled. I hope this is an outsider. I hope this isn't somebody in my house. We're not close to fascism. And I'm glad you asked this question, because this goes right to the heart of what I was saying a few minutes ago about the sky is falling. Look, there's always, particularly in a time when there are, you know, is a fear of legitimate or otherwise, of outsiders, of foreign domination, of war, of enemies, there's always a danger area when it comes to civil liberties. But compared to past eras of American history, we're not, I mean, please go back and look at what happened in World War I, when newspapers were shut down for opposing the war, when 5 socialist members of the New York State Legislature were expelled, when hundreds of people were rounded up and deported by the Attorney General of the United States, A. Mitchell Palmer. Look at what happened in World War II. I mean, it happened in this state, for heaven's sakes, at Manzanar, when Japanese Americans were rounded up and put in literally, not death camps, but concentration camps. We're not there. 2/3 of this country is against the war in Iraq. When you've got Republican senators right now calling for the resignation of the Republican-appointed Attorney General of the United States. You know, there are times in this country when it was right to be afraid of what was going to happen. This ain't one of them. And if I may, since I assume that there are a fair number of people in this audience who consider themselves progressives or liberals, whatever the term of art is these days, for the last 20 or 25 years, I've just gotten really annoyed when people begin their talk saying, I'm frightened. You know, if you don't like what the people in power are doing, you go organize to kick them out. That's what you do. Now, there are things that this administration has done with respect to the expansion of executive power that are very troubling. Don't misunderstand me. And that's, you know, and then we're going to see whether this Congress begins to push back hard and begin to unravel it. There are things that have been done that the basic, I think, temporary abolition of the right of habeas corpus of some of these folks, that is a really troublesome thing. But it is not, that's not fascism. Particularly when you've got a Congress in the United States that may well say, you know what, that's a bad idea. You've not talked about public radio. NPR is up 40%. Why? Well, I think for one thing, as mainstream news gets more and more trivial, people are looking for more serious news. I think the Jim Lehrer NewsHour does pretty well. In fact, my colleagues in the cable industry don't like this, but you know, I think the Jim Lehrer NewsHour does as well, if not better, than any single newscast on cable. I'm not sure that O'Reilly doesn't beat them, but it's close. And during the conventions, they do way better, except Fox News at the Republican convention. So people are turning to that. And I also, by the way, look, I, you know, Do I think Fox News tilts right? I do. Do I think National Public Radio tilts left? I do. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a propaganda arm, but, you know, do the math. Go, you know, there are certain things you can kind of conclude by kind of common sense. You data mine. Do I think that more people who listen to NPR drive foreign cars than, say, people who watch Fox News drive foreign cars? Yeah, I bet the farm on that one. Do I think that NPR listeners tend to eat more what they think of as natural food than, say, Fox News and maybe less McDonald's? Yeah, I believe that. And do I think that NPR listeners tend to vote more Democratic than, say, the listeners of other media? I do. You know, partly because they appeal to more people in the academy and, you know, call me madcap, my hunch is there are slightly more liberals and conservatives in the American academy. I don't know where I got that insight from, but I believe it's true. So what? You know? But I also think NPR is a refuge for people who are just, they really don't want the network news to go into this much detail about Anna Nicole Smith's autopsy or Britney Spears' undergarments. And that's why I think that's happening. When does my Colbert interview air? I don't know. You have to check the Comedy Central website. But I will tell you this, it's really good. What do I think of Bill O'Reilly? Well, okay. No, I mean, I need to sort this out. When, to some extent, when somebody arises out of nowhere and draws an audience like that, you at least, to quote Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. What's that about? See, that's what I prefer to do. That's about a guy who has created a persona of the guy at the end of the bar stool, you know, wanting to know who's sticking up for the little guy. All these big shots with their fancy Dan suits and their fancy degrees and their big talk, they're not looking out. That's one of the titles of his books. Who's looking out for you? I am. No spin zone. I'm going to give it to you straight. Do I think he does? No. I think sometimes he does and sometimes he bloviates. And I think he's gone. I mean, the reason why the Colbert character works is that Colbert has nailed this notion that it's true because I think it's true. Truthiness. There was actually long before Colbert. There was a bit on Saturday Night Live where the O'Reilly guy says, so, Professor, you think California has more people than New York? I'm not buying this. I go to California, I see lots of empty beaches. I go to New York, it's crowded all the time. And to some extent, that's O'Reilly. Anyway, we've come to the end of our revels here, and thank you for listening. And students, stay while we...